From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Senate Republicans block a Democratic proposal to begin a partial withdrawal of troops from Iraq, often lashing out at Iran. This follows a resolution to censure Iran for Iranian fighters in Iraq. We'll go to Baghdad to speak with a reporter who says there are more Saudi foreign fighters in Iraq. Then we'll talk about two reporters being held by U.S. forces without charge. Al Jazeera cameraman Sami Alhaj has been held at Guantanamo for more than 5 years. Pulitzer Prize-winning cameraman Bilal Hussein of AP has been held in Iraq for over a year. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Senate Republicans have thwarted a Democratic measure that would have begun a partial withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. On Wednesday, Democrats fell 8 votes shy of the 60 needed to avoid a Republican filibuster. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid had tried to break the deadlock by keeping the Senate in session around the clock Tuesday night. When that failed, Reid announced he would withdraw the entire defense authorization bill to pressure Republican lawmakers.
Regrettably, Republicans chose to block this amendment. They chose to block a bipartisan amendment, Mr. President, to deny the American people an up or down vote. They chose to continue protecting their president instead of our troops, no matter the cost to our country.
The move is likely to grant President Bush his plea for the Senate to keep Iraq off the table until General David Petraeus issues a progress report in September. Recent polls show 7 out of 10 Americans favor withdrawal from Iraq. 6 out of 10 say Congress should only fund the war on condition a timetable for withdrawal is set. In news from Iraq, several thousand people took part in demonstrations Wednesday demanding better basic services. Most of Iraq sees only limited electricity in the midst of the summer heat. Many Iraqis are also without water and food. This is cleric Nihad al-Zarqani.
As for our demands, they are the demands of all the people. We represent the people, and our demands are the provision of services, security, and stability, and an end to unemployment, and the provision of electricity and water, and all the things that ensure a decent life.
In other Iraq news, the Iraqi government is accusing Turkey of bombing northern areas. Officials say Turkish troops fired more than 200 shells on the Iraqi side of the border. Turkey has threatened to invade Iraq's northern area where Kurdish groups are based. 2 U.S. soldiers have been charged with murdering an Iraqi civilian in Kirkuk last month. A lieutenant colonel has been relieved of command in connection with the case. No further details were released. Meanwhile, a U.S. Marine has been convicted for the kidnapping and murder of an Iraqi civilian in the town of Hamdaniyeh last year. On Wednesday, U.S. Marine Corporal Trent Thomas was found guilty for his role in the death of Hashim Ibrahim Awad. Awad was dragged from his home, shot, and then planted with a weapon to make it appear he was a militant planning an attack. 5 other service members have pleaded guilty in the case. President Bush has renewed a threat to veto a bill that would extend health insurance to more than 3 million low-income children. Last week, senators reached a bipartisan agreement to add $35 billion to the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, over the next 5 years by increasing federal taxes on cigarettes. Senators say the extra funding would help cover some of the nation's 8 million uninsured children, as well as some adults with incomes too high to qualify for Medicaid but not high enough to afford private insurance. President Bush wants Congress to limit the increase to just $5 billion. On Wednesday, he repeated his threat to veto the bill.
I believe government cannot provide affordable health care. I believe it would cause the quality of care to diminish. I believe there would be lines and rationing over time. If Congress continues to insist upon expanding health care through the SCHIP program, which, by the way, would entail a huge tax increase for the American people, I'll veto the bill.
Many consider renewal of the SCHIP, or State Children's Health Insurance Program, the most important health legislation taken up by Congress this year. In the occupied territories, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has announced he'll order early parliamentary elections in response to Hamas' seizure of power last month in the Gaza Strip. Hamas spokesperson Sami Abu Zuhri dismissed the call as illegitimate.
The president's call for early elections is unacceptable, unconstitutional, and illegal. It will remain only as ink on paper, and neither Abbas nor all the papers and all the international powers who support him will be able to hold any election as long as Hamas rejects it.
In Iran, two of the three imprisoned Iranian Americans have appeared on national television in a state-backed documentary. Hala Estafandiari, director of the Middle East program at the Washington-based Woodrow Wilson Center for Scholars, and urban planning consultant Kian Tajbakhsh have been jailed since May. They're both charged with spying and endangering national security. On Wednesday, the state documentary showed the two admitting involvement in U.S.-funded political efforts in Iran, but stopping short of making a confession. United Nations inspectors say they verified North Korea's shutdown of its five nuclear facilities. This is International Atomic Energy Agency Director Mohammed El-Baradei.
We now verified that all the five nuclear facilities has been shut down and that appropriate measures has been put in place, including sealing some of these facilities. We expect that in the next few weeks we will continue to apply the necessary monitoring and verification measures. So the facilities, all the five facilities right now are shut down, and we verified that.
El-Baradei was speaking ahead of six-party talks that begin in Beijing on Wednesday. In South Africa, Nelson Mandela celebrated his 89th birthday on Wednesday. The anti-apartheid leader and former South African president marked the occasion by announcing the launch of an international group of veteran world leaders to tackle global issues.
Using their collective experience, their moral courage, and their ability to rise above the parochial concerns of nation, race, and creed, they can help make our planet a more peaceful, healthy, and equitable place to live.
The group includes former President Jimmy Carter.
No adverse political consequences in prospect of criticism from constituency or seeking public office, we will be able to risk failure in worthy causes, and we will not need to claim credit for any successes that might be achieved.
In addition to Carter and Mandela, other group members include South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu, former Irish President Mary Robinson, and former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. Back in the United States, Jose Padilla's defense teams begin presenting evidence today at Padilla's terror trial in Miami. He was initially accused of plotting a dirty bomb attack and labeled an enemy combatant. He was later indicted on lesser offenses and now stands accused of aiding al-Qaeda. The presiding judge has called the case light on facts. Padilla was held in extreme isolation without almost any human contact for 1,300 days and denied an attorney for nearly 2 years. His attorneys say he was tortured to the point where he is now incapable of assisting in his own defense. Florida has resumed capital punishment after a seven-month reprieve. Then-Governor Jeb Bush ordered a moratorium after a death row prisoner took 34 minutes to die from lethal injections. Here in New York, state officials have filed a lawsuit against the oil giant ExxonMobil over its alleged failure to clean up millions of gallons of spilled oil over the last century. In a statement, New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo called the spill in the Greenpoint section of Brooklyn one of the worst environmental disasters in the nation's history. Exxon says the suit is unfounded. Studies show Exxon has spilled more than 17 million gallons of oil into the Hudson River. That's 7 million more than the 1989 Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska. In Washington state, a judge has dismissed charges against 13 of the 23 peace activists who tried to prevent the military from shipping 300 Stryker armored vehicles to Iraq earlier this year. A new study says police crackdowns and legislation targeting gangs are failing so badly they're actually making U.S. cities more dangerous. In a new report, the Justice Policy Institute says punitive measures, including mass arrests and stiff prison sentences, are strengthening gang ties and further marginalizing the youths they target. The findings based on interviews and analysis of previously published statistics and reports, the Justice Policy Institute says efforts should be geared towards an intervention-based approach. Meanwhile, the prisoner rights group, the Sentencing Project, has released a report showing continuing racial disparities in prison sentences. African Americans are jailed at 5 times the rate of white prisoners. Latinos are jailed at double the rate. And the New York poet Sekou Tsundiata has died at the age of 58. He was one of the country's most celebrated spoken word artists. Ani DiFranco released 2 of his recordings on her own Righteous Babe label. Tsundiata was a professor of English literature at the New School. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our viewers and listeners around the country and around the world. On Capitol Hill, Senate Republicans blocked a proposal by Democrats on Wednesday to begin a partial withdrawal of troops from Iraq. 52 senators voted to support the pullout measure proposed by Democratic Senators Carl Levin and Jack Reed. But the Democratic leadership failed to get the needed 60 votes to break the Republican filibuster. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid first tried to break the filibuster by keeping the Senate in session around the clock on Tuesday night. When that failed, Reid announced he would withdraw the entire defense authorization bill in an attempt to pressure Republican lawmakers.
Republicans chose to block this amendment. They chose to block a bipartisan amendment, Mr. President, to deny the American people an up or down vote. They chose to continue protecting their president instead of our troops, no matter the cost to our country. In contrast, my Democratic colleagues and a number of brave Republicans came to the floor throughout the night to make our case, and I'm proud of what they've said and what they've done. We spent 2 days showing America that we're not going to back down. We're going to continue to fight. That if President Bush and his allies in Congress refuse to budge, we'll continue to show them the way.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky criticized Reid's tactics.
Last night's theatrics accomplished nothing. Nearly every major newspaper in America noted this morning that we could have had the vote on the 11 troop withdrawal amendment without any of the fanfare. And that's really all it amounted to, a sound and fury. Because after 24 hours of debate, after all the gags and giggles and gimmicks, the cold pizza and the empty cots, the essential thing remained unsaid. We still don't know what the amendment we're about to vote on would mean for our troops, our allies, our mission, or our interests.
The bill's co-sponsor, Senator Carl Levin, urged lawmakers to support a partial withdrawal of troops.
If there's any hope of forcing the Iraqi political leaders to take responsibility for their own country, it's to have a timetable to begin reducing American forces and to redeploy our forces to a more limited support mission instead of being everybody's target in the middle of a civil war. That transition is the only way that we can force the Iraqi leaders to act. If the Republican leaders' procedural roadblock succeeds this morning, we will be denied the opportunity to vote on an issue which just about every American has strong feelings on.
We go now to Iraq to speak with Ned Parker, staff reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He joins us from Baghdad. Ned Parker recently wrote a widely read article on how Sunni militants from Saudi Arabia make up half the foreign fighters in Iraq. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ned Parker.
Oh, thank you.
It's good to have you with us. We saw over and over again on the Senate floor as ultimately the attempt to pass the resolution that would begin withdrawal of troops from Iraq was defeated. We saw Iran raised, and the idea that in Iraq, U.S. soldiers were fighting off Iranian insurgents, and that was part of what the battle in Iraq was all about, taking on Iran. You found that, in fact, there are more Saudi than Iranian foreign fighters in Iraq. How do you know this?
Well, it's I mean, the Iranian issue is complicated, to say the least. It's from America's U.S. military's own numbers about foreign fighters in Iraq, that there are more Saudis fighting in Iraq than Iranians. That said, the Iranian element, and there's no doubt that the Iranians are involved in Iraq and that they are backing Shia militias. The military believes that this is with full consent backing. The Saudi issue is more complicated because it's not really clear what the Saudi government is really doing. Are they actively involved in sending these Saudi fighters to Iraq, or are they just sort of letting it happen as a way to pressure the Shia government there? So, and then Saudis are the United States allies, Iran is, so there's all that at play.
And your report also gives some indication of the total number of foreign fighters, which I found, that, or at least the ones that are in custody, which I found to be somewhat low in terms of what we might imagine. Could you talk about the actual numbers?
Right. I mean, their numbers, I mean, it's still, I think the Americans would even say that their numbers aren't precise. It's based upon detainees arrested over the years, detainees currently in prison. Right now, there's, I think, 130 foreign fighters in U.S. custody. Of those, 45% are Saudi. The United States guesses that there are between 60 and 80 foreign fighters who cross into Iraq each month through Syria. So almost half of those, according to the United States, would be Saudi. So it is actually, it's a fairly low number in the scheme of things. And the United States, even in releasing these numbers, was saying that the Saudi foot soldiers are being used as suicide bombers for the most part, or fighters on the ground, people with a very quick shelf life that are probably going to die. But they're quite open about the fact that the majority of al-Qaeda in Iraq, even if it has a foreign leadership, is Iraqi. And, that shouldn't be lost sight of. The vast majority of al-Qaeda in Iraq is Iraqi.
And what did the military brass in Iraq tell you about their efforts to try to get Saudi Arabia to somehow or other control the jihadist fighters that are leaving their country?
Well, the officers I've spoken with, they believe that the Saudi government should be doing a tougher job on its border with Jordan, because that's the flow of Saudi fighters to Iraq, often by bus or plane via Jordan to Syria, or by plane perhaps direct to Syria. So their objection is that there's no sense of real vigorous screening of the males crossing the border, meaning that if they fit a certain profile, there's no questioning of them. They just let people go. It's not suspicious if they have very little money, narrow possessions. It seems they're going for a very short trip. There's no effort to stop them, according to U.S. military officers I've spoken with.
And
Iraqi, for that matter.
And what are the military brass saying about the fact that they are Saudi? I mean, I think most people in this country, they now believe there are a number of Iranians fighting in Iraq, not Saudis, in the same way that probably many people in the United States don't realize the vast majority of those who flew the planes on 9/11 were Saudi and not Iraqi.
More needs to be done, and a sense of, I think, frustration that the issue isn't dealt with publicly, that because Saudi Arabia is an ally of the United States, our decision has been made for diplomatic reasons to not publicize this number. But the numbers are right, and even after the article came out, the State Department officials, grudgingly admitted that it was correct here in Iraq.
And, Ned, how is it for you to report in Iraq right now?
How easy is it? It's a very difficult place to report right now. We still do get out and go around this Baghdad, where they're on embeds or just going solo on our own. Everything has to be done very carefully because it definitely is a dangerous place to work for everyone.
And could you tell us also, you interviewed some Saudi officials, their reaction to the criticisms that they're getting about not controlling the people leaving their country. What was the Saudi official reaction to your story?
Well, you know, I mean, I think there's a wide variety of opinions among Saudi officials. When I was writing the article, I spoke with a spokesman for the Saudi Interior Ministry, and he was quite blunt about the fact that it is a huge problem that Saudis are going to fight in Iraq. And but, you know, asked about their ability to do more to stop the flow, the spokesman said, you know, it's not our fault. We're not going to screen our citizens who are traveling abroad. The Iraqi government doesn't talk to us. On the other hand, the Iraqis will say that we've constantly tried to engage the Saudis about this issue, and there has not been any strong interest by the Saudis to help. Now, I mean, depending how you want to view the situation, it very much plays into probably this antagonism between Saudi Arabia, which is a very Sunni country, a fundamentalist conservative that sees Iraq with the Shiite majority as a potential threat, as a possible, you know, proxy for Iran. So all of that comes into play. Saudi officials have been critical of al-Qaeda. They certainly fought their own war with al-Qaeda inside Saudi Arabia. But then the issue of fighters going to Iraq is just another, you know, side to the, another dimension to the problem.
Ned Parker, last week in President Bush's news conference, he didn't mention Saudi foreign fighters, but he blamed Syria for not stopping suicide bombers from going into Iraq through Syria.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sure. There's probably a legitimate, I suppose, grievance there in saying that. I mean, there are Syrian intel officers on the borders, and there isn't real, from what I'm told, effort to stop the flow. But could he say the same thing about Saudi Arabia? It sounds like he could. Certainly U.S. military officials believe so, and Iraqi officials, and the proof is in the pudding. I mean, the most foreign fighters in Iraq are Saudi, but Saudi Arabia is the United States' ally. In Saudi Arabia, it seems that certainly the Saudis are involved in trying to break whatever, quote-unquote, Islamist extremist tie to sell. So how do you deal with an ally who might be playing it both ways? It's a tough one. And so Syria is considered an enemy by the United States. Saudi Arabia is not. So it doesn't get singled out in the same way.
Finally, Ned Parker, what President Bush calls the surge, the increased number of U.S. soldiers in Iraq, what effect has this had?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
What effect has the surge had, the increased number of U.S. soldiers in Iraq?
Well, I think it has had an effect. I mean, it's, you know, the problem is that the surge is taking place within a politically charged debate in the United States between Democrats and Republicans, and perhaps a lot of the feelings about Iraq reflect disillusionment or disenchantment with the president's leadership. But the surge itself, I mean, it definitely has, in some areas, stabilized the situation. It doesn't mean that things are safe. It just means that the killing's gone down a bit. Now, if you care about Iraqis and you live with Iraqis and you witness what they're going through every day, that's a good thing. Certainly, though, people are still dying. I think the surge will take time, and probably the expectations or the timelines in the United States for how long it should take are unrealistic. It would probably take much longer.
Ned Parker, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Ned Parker is speaking to us from Baghdad, staff writer with the Los Angeles Times. Be safe. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
Aman 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 aman.
قدرت في بيت شعر احترت في بيت شعر وددت به مدحكم واخترت للنصيب بيتا لعلني به صائب أنتم البرد أنتم البدر والناس الكواكب حولكم.
Amir Taufik from the soundtrack of the film about Baghdad. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In recent weeks, lawmakers have repeatedly warned about the role played by foreign militants in Iraq, but the focus has not been Saudi Arabia, but Iran. This is what independent Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut said on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos.
Arab diplomats say to me 2 weeks ago that what is happening in the Middle East today reminds him of what happened in Europe during the 1930s, when Nazi Germany began to make moves and the rest of Europe and the United States did not act quick enough to stop the Second World War. He was talking about Iran. Iran is on the move in Iraq, Lebanon, Palestine, and Afghanistan. And if we pull out of Iraq, Iran and al-Qaeda are the victors. And so my answer is, as long as we have a reasonable chance of success in Iraq, then I'm going to say it's worth it for us to stay, because if Iran and al-Qaeda take over Iraq, they will destabilize the entire Middle East, and they will strike at us here at home
with more
frequency and ferocity.
I also want to bring into this conversation Toby Jones, former Persian Gulf analyst with the International Crisis Group, completing a fellowship at Swarthmore College, teaching history at Rutgers University this fall. Can you elaborate on what the reporter in Baghdad was talking to us about?
Well, it's certainly not breaking news that Saudis have been involved in Iraq since early in 2003. As early as 2004 and 2005, when I was last in the Gulf for an extended period of time, there were figures tossed about by both Saudi officials and citizens alike that there were upwards of 2,500 to 3,000 Saudis to that point who had traveled from the kingdom to Iraq to participate in the insurgency. I think the kingdom has done a better job in recent years of trying to crack down on the flow of militants back and forth between the two countries, but it's certainly unable to control or stem the tide completely. And that's compounded by an additional problem that Saudi security and police officials are unable to, or have proven unwilling to, crack down on the ideologues within the kingdom who foment both anti-American sentiment and a growing anti-Shiism, which simply supports or provides succor to Saudis who desire to go and fight in the jihad.
But then the press attention and the emphasis of our political leaders in this country don't deal with the fact either that so many of the foreign fighters are coming from Saudi Arabia, or that they are retraining and regrouping in Pakistan in terms of the continuing war of al-Qaeda. These are, of course, two American allies in the Middle East.
Well, it's symptomatic of the war more generally, in that the United States has proven mostly incapable of managing the political forces that are driving violence in both of those two places. It's unwilling to sacrifice its alliances for whatever, however it defines its interests in the region. In the case of Saudi Arabia, it's both because the U.S. considers Saudi Arabia to be a stabilizing ally, perhaps ironically, given its role in destabilizing Iraq, and Pakistan similarly in Central Asia. So the inability of the United States to manage its political affairs at this point shouldn't come as much of a surprise. But I think that's the lesson also about the question of addressing Saudi fighters in Iraq, is that the U.S. has been disinterested, more inclined to talk about Iran and the regional threat that Iran allegedly represents than the details on the ground.
Toby Jones, can you talk about the prisoners who've just been released from Guantanamo to Saudi Arabia, like Zasari, and then the Lackawanna Six, the people upstate New York, and Buffalo, the Yemenis who were arrested?
Well, I mean, the number of Saudis in detention in Guantanamo is decreasing steadily over time. They're being repatriated, released back into Saudi custody. So that number is diminishing. What's happening to those former detainees in Saudi Arabia is unclear. Some of them are being tried. Others are being released into the care of their families. Their fates after that is unknown. That reflects more generally Saudi Arabia's handling of the militant question, more generally, in which it attempts to regenerate or rescue militants from their radical ways. With respect to Dosari's trip to upstate New York, my understanding is that he, according to the Washington Post, gave some rousing talks to audiences in Lackawanna. And of course, we have six alleged members of al-Qaeda from New York who have been arrested and gained quite some notoriety. I can't speak specifically to Dosari's role in any of that. I'm not familiar with his personal experiences in the region. But I think that it shouldn't be surprising that the detainees and others have traveled back and forth and globally to preach radical messages. But that doesn't necessarily indict him or any of the other detainees with specific acts of militancy or terrorism.
And Vice President Cheney going to Saudi Arabia, what is his connection with Saudi Arabia and Saudi Arabia's concerns in Iraq right now, not wanting troops to be pulled out?
Well, Cheney, along with Bush, and really it must be said that the United States has maintained a close relationship with Saudi Arabia since the mid-1940s. So arguments that the Bush family represents some parallel to the House of Saud as a kind of dynastic American political family are really wide of the mark. The United States has made very clear that it's willing to protect its interests in the Persian Gulf, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, included with military force. Cheney's interest in pushing Saudi Arabia quietly, I mean, the fact that Cheney gets sent as opposed to somebody who's willing to take a high-profile media position, indicates that the U.S. wants to push quietly behind the scenes, but is interested in pressuring the Saudis to deal seriously with both the question of the insurgency and how Saudi Arabia might be involved more productively in Iraq. From Saudi Arabia's perspective, I think it understands that it faces a paradoxical dilemma in Iraq. On the one hand, it fears the rise and perhaps a rise to the hegemonic power of a Shia-dominated Iraq. Whether Shia Iraq acts as a proxy for Iran or not, it threatens Saudi Arabia's sense of hegemony in the Gulf. Secondarily, contradictorily, it also fears instability in Iraq. So it would like to see the United States stay in Iraq in order to contain the insurgency as best as possible so that it doesn't spill over Iraq's borders and into the Gulf. But at the same time, it sees the U.S. as strengthening Shia power in Iraq. So Saudi Arabia is struggling much like other powers are in figuring out how best to determine its policy there.
And how stable is the Saudi government itself vis-a-vis its own population and its own domestic unrest? It has a significant Shia minority within Saudi Arabia itself, and in addition to, obviously, a much more radicalized youth in its population.
I don't think Saudi Arabia is poised to topple anytime soon. Of course, those could be famous last words, but Saudi Arabia has proven resilient. It's very strong. It's managed to crack down severely on its own domestic al-Qaeda threat. We might argue that it's shipping fighters off so that it deflects pressure on itself. The royal family is mostly united at this point. There are future concerns about succession after King Abdullah passes. Sultan will take over, but there is no indication that they've resolved who will then be third in line to power. And that could open Saudi Arabia up to internal rivalries within the royal family. As for Saudi Arabia's Shia population, there are about 1.5 to 2 million Shias who reside mostly in the eastern province. The region is strategically sensitive because it's where all of Saudi Arabia's oil is. Most Saudi Shias have pursued a political line of accommodation and reconciliation since the early 1990s. They've sought to be included in the national political system. That hasn't worked particularly well, but they've not radicalized significantly. There should be a concern that there will be an Iraq effect on al-Qaeda's strategic thinking more broadly outside of Iraq, and that anti-Shiism endemic in Iraq may spread and become a strategic approach that al-Qaeda adopts outside of Iraq, and that makes Shia communities in Bahrain, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, like in Pakistan, vulnerable to future strikes.
Toby Jones, want to thank you very much for being with us. Persian Gulf analyst with the International Crisis Group until last year, now completing a fellowship at Swarthmore College and will be teaching at Rutgers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. As we talk about reporters now, reporters held by U.S. troops at Guantanamo and Iraq. Juan?
Yes, well, the release of BBC reporter Alan Johnston earlier this month after 114 days in captivity in Gaza made headlines around the world and was hailed internationally as a victory for press freedom. During Johnston's nearly 4 months in captivity, calls for his release came from world leaders and human rights organizations alike. Over 200,000 people signed an online petition calling for him to be freed. But perhaps the most poignant of Johnston's supporters came from deep within the U.S. prison camp at Guantanamo Bay. Sami Al-Haj, an Al Jazeera cameraman who had been jailed without charge at Guantanamo for the past 5.5 years, sent a letter via his lawyer calling for Johnston's release. He wrote, quote, "While the United States has kidnapped me and held me for years on end, this is not a lesson that Muslims should copy."
In comparison to journalist Alan Johnston, Sami Al-Haj's story of abduction has been largely ignored by the corporate media, kept out of the global spotlight. He's a Sudanese national. Al-Haj was working as a cameraman for the Arabic television network Al Jazeera when he was detained on December 15, 2001, at a Pakistani town on the border with Afghanistan. After being transferred to U.S. custody, he was flown to Bagram Air Base, 6 months later flown to Guantanamo. He's been imprisoned there without charge ever since. A new article detailing Sami Al-Haj's ordeal is the cover story of the latest issue of the Columbia Journalism Review. It's called Prisoner 345, What Happened to Al Jazeera's Sami Al-Haj. It's written by Rachel Morris, an editor at the Washington Monthly. Rachel joins us now from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Rachel. How did you learn about Sami Al-Haj? Why did you do this piece?
Well, I'd been reading and following what had been happening in Guantanamo ever since the first prisoners were sent over there. And after the lawyers first got access to the prisoners in 2004, very, very slowly you started to see, you know, reports and even eventually a couple of books coming out by, you know, people who had been released. So I was really keeping track of trying to figure out who was in there and what some of their individual stories were. And one of the people that I came across, I think through a press release from the Committee to Protect Journalists, which has been following Sami Al-Haj's case, had noted that he was in Guantanamo. And it surprised me that I hadn't heard anything about him to date, because it seemed like the idea of a cameraman for Al Jazeera being inside Guantanamo was such a novelty and so surprising that I assumed that people would have written plenty of stories about it. And then when I sort of started looking into it, I found that there was really not that much here written about him at all. And so I started to basically report the story from there.
And in your piece, you go into a lot of his history, his upbringing, and his entry into journalism. Could you talk a little about who he is?
Sure. When I was reporting the piece, I talked to, you know, friends and family and as many of his former colleagues from Al Jazeera as I could track down. And in terms of his actual personal life, I, you know, didn't manage to provide an incredibly detailed picture of who he was. But from what I know, he grew up in the Sudan, and his family was not particularly well off, and went to university in India, where he studied English and computer studies, which is one of the reasons that he was hired by Al Jazeera, because of his skills in those two areas. And from what people have told me from, you know, a pretty early age, he was an avid reader, followed the media very closely, particularly Al Jazeera, read a lot of newspapers, just a very sort of interested student of what's going on in the world. He started at Al Jazeera in around 2000 as a trainee cameraman. They sort of started him on a trial basis. And so he was, you know, relatively inexperienced when he wound up going to Afghanistan in 2001.
And what exactly was he doing on the border? And then explain what happened, how he ended up in Guantanamo, and what the U.S. government has said about him.
Sure. Well, Essentially, he initially went to Afghanistan fairly soon after the U.S. Started military operations there, and was filming for one of its correspondents and working out of a bureau in Kandahar, which was operated by CNN. And the Al Jazeera and the CNN crews spent some time together and got to know each other a little bit, and, you know, there was some sort of interaction there. And then after about a month or so, I think, the initial Al Jazeera correspondent who had gone there had to return. And so Sami Al-Haj went back to Pakistan to meet the replacement. And so it was when the new correspondent and Al-Haj were attempting to re-enter Afghanistan to continue reporting that that was when he was detained. And the other correspondent was not, you know, held in any way. It was just Pakistani intelligence claimed to have, you know, a letter saying that Al-Haj was suspected of terrorist activities or links to terrorists and should be stopped if he was found at a border point. In terms of what the U.S. has said about him, it took an awfully long time before, you know, any sort of official statement or, you know, description of what he was alleged to have done came out at all. I mean, really, for the first couple of years, nobody really knew why he was there at all. People from Al Jazeera had attempted to make some contact with U.S. authorities, not sort of that much in the initial stages of his detention, and they really couldn't learn that much about why he was there. It was all sort of very vague statements about, you know, him having sort of suspicious links with terrorist organizations, but not really any specifics. It wasn't until basically he got a lawyer, and then that after the Supreme Court ruling in 2004 that, you know, said that the detainees had to have some sort of, you know, process to determine their status, that basically you started to get these sort of, they're not really charges at all, or sort of allegations. They're called a summary of evidence, and it sort of summarizes what the government says it has on each detainee. And the evidence that they have said that they've got has sort of changed over time. Initially, his lawyer was told that, you know, they thought that he had been trying to purchase Stinger missiles in Afghanistan. Then it changed to Stinger missiles in Chechnya. The most recent record that I have seen had dropped those charges entirely. There'd also been a sort of, when he was first picked up, people in Afghanistan had said, you know, we think you record, you know, videos for Osama bin Laden. That was never stated in any sort of official capacity. That was something he was accused of by guards in Afghanistan not long after he was transferred to American custody.
Rachel Morris, we have to break, but we're going to come back, and I want to ask you about his lawyer contending that the U.S. authorities said they'd release him if he would be a spy on his own network, on Al Jazeera. Rachel Morris is the editor of Washington Monthly, wrote a cover story of the Columbia Journalism Review on the more than five-year detention of Sami Al-Haj, Al Jazeera cameraman, at Guantanamo. We're also going to talk about a Pulitzer Prize-winning AP photographer who's being held by U.S. military in Iraq for more than a year. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute. Ani DeFranco, your next bold move. Ani DeFranco, close to Sekou Sundiata, who died this week at the age of 58, the great New York poet. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest, Rachel Morris, editor at The Washington Monthly, author of a new piece on Sami Al-Haj, Al Jazeera cameraman, who has been held at Guantanamo for 5.5 years. Rachel, is it true that his attorney, Clive Stafford Smith, said that Sami Al-Haj told him that U.S. authorities said they'd release him if he was willing to spy on his own network on Al Jazeera?
That's right. What Clive Stafford Smith has told me is that really ever since Al-Haj has been in Guantanamo, that he's had around 130 interrogations approximately, and around 125 of them have concerned his work for Al Jazeera rather than any, you know, alleged terrorist links or anything like that. And that at some point during one or more of those interrogations, he was told that if he, you know, would inform on the network, that he would be released.
We want to bring Scott Horton into this conversation. We want him also to talk about the photographer who's being held by U.S. military in Iraq for more than a year. But I want to stay on this subject. Scott Horton, New York attorney specializing in international law. He formerly served as the head of the New York City Bar Association. And also is with the Iraq Bar Association, a member of that bar. Scott, what about this allegation of Sami Al-Haj?
Well, when I heard about this, I discussed it with Clive Stafford Smith earlier. And when I heard it, it struck me as amazing because it's a consistent pattern with detentions of journalists that occurred in Iraq, particularly two cases that I worked on. Directly, the one involving the CBS cameraman, Abdulamir Yunus Hussein, and then later the AP photographer, Bilal Hussein. In both cases, when they were detained and interrogated, the interrogators were heavily focused on the internal functionings of the news organizations they worked with, wanted to know what was going on, how they interacted, how they hired local staffers to pursue their work. So it seemed to be gathering intelligence on the media rather than with respect to any notion of a crime or wrongdoing by these people.
And the AP report photographer, can you talk to us about his case?
Yes. Well, he's now been in prison since April 5th of last year, more than a year, and we still don't know the reasons for his detention. In fact, in discussing this with the military, almost every time you talk to them, they have different concerns that they trot out. I investigated those concerns for about 8 months. I found virtually every specific fact that they trotted out as a basis for concern was simply untrue. They refused to bring charges of any kind. In fact, Sami Al-Haj just said he was kidnapped. Well, I would say Bilal Hussein has been kidnapped by the military. There is no legal justification of any kind for his detention.
How was he grabbed initially?
He was grabbed in Ramadi and by a patrol. The initial announcement by the Baghdad command was that he was caught red-handed in some sort of action. Of course, I interviewed some of the people who were involved in detaining him. They told me that was a complete lie, that they had been sent out on a mission to get him and that the instructions had come way, way, way up the chain of command. In fact, the implication being that it hadn't been decided in Baghdad, it had been decided in the Pentagon in Washington.
So the U.S. government simply calls him a security threat, and on those grounds alone, they can just hold him indefinitely?
They claim to be able to seize and hold anyone as a security threat indefinitely without charges, without review, without presenting cases to the courts.
What is AP doing about this?
I have not been involved in the matter since the end of last year, but, you know, the president of AP and numerous senior people there have been very aggressive in this case, and they've been pursuing it along several different channels, including, I think, a very intense dialogue with the Pentagon.
You referred to the U.S. cameraman. This is the case that you seriously investigated. In fact, didn't you represent him,
CBS cameraman, that's right.
Explain his case to give us some insight. He has since been released.
He was released 1 week before Bilal Hussein was arrested. In fact, we think there's some connection between these two events. But he had been taking pictures of an attack on an American convoy that occurred in Mosul in the north of Iraq, and he was shot as he did this. CBS was told in the first couple of hours after the event that he was going to be released, and then he continued to be held, and he kept being moved around. And we learned that the center of decision-making had passed out of Iraq and was being taken in the Pentagon in Washington. And in the Pentagon in Washington, unnamed senior press spokesman, we believe an assistant secretary of defense, were telling reporters off the record and not for attribution that he had been found with photographs of four separate incidents of attacks on Americans at the time of the attack. And when we got to the end of the case in the trial, we discovered that was a conscious lie. Absolutely not the case. But it was reported, by the way, on CBS on continuous feed for 30, excuse me, on CNN on continuous feed for 36 hours, as well as on Fox News. Neither of them ever corrected the false statements that were put out.
What is the impact on the journalists who are in Iraq when you have situations like this of the military just grabbing people and holding them indefinitely without charges?
Well, we have, I mean, we need to start with the fact that we have more than 110 journalists at this point who have been killed in Iraq. That's twice the number who were killed in World War II. The number of journalists who've been arrested is now into the thousands. Most of those arrests are simply for establishing identity, and they are resolved in a period of 4 to 6 hours. But many of them have gone on for weeks and indeed months. And it is, it creates continuous pressure on the journalists. But the most disturbing thing here is a tendency on the part of the U.S. military to view these journalists as, quote, the enemy. And back 3 months ago, we actually got to see some classified operational security briefing materials that were prepared by the Department of Defense, in which they labeled journalists in the category together with al-Qaeda and drug dealers as potential enemy to be treated and viewed as such. That leads to people being killed, by the way.
I wanted to go back to Samuel Hajj and also to talk about the hunger strike he had engaged in. But first, I wanted to turn to the head of Al Jazeera. In February of 2006, Democracy Now! Traveled to the headquarters of Al Jazeera in Doha, Qatar. Wada Khanfar serves as the managing director of Al Jazeera. This is what he had to say about Samuel Hajj at the time.
For more than 3 years, he is still in Guantanamo Bay. And we have received some letters from him, that goes through the American, guards. But basically, I would say that the issue of Samuel Hajj, again, is creating that rift and that feeling that there are many things that have gone wrong in the relationship between the Arab world and the United States of America after the 11th of September. We have been, I remember, as a journalist, before 2001, a lot of our Arab governments feared, and they were very, it was difficult for them to jail a journalist because they would say then that the Americans will make big loud voice about it and they will condemn us. So they will respect a little bit of freedom of expression for us to act because they don't want to make big issue from the American society and organizations. Now we have someone who is spending more than 3 years in jail, and we cannot even get any real explanation why he is there and what is the crime of Samuel Hajj to be held in Guantanamo.
I'm looking at the pamphlet that says Sami's first interrogation at Guantanamo came after 2 days of sleep deprivation. Agents from the Pentagon, CIA, FBI were present, but as much as they wanted to extract incriminating evidence from Sami, they were as interested in gaining inside information about Al Jazeera and recruiting him as a spy, both in Guantanamo and in the event of his release.
How could we explain this? I mean, I have read this in the newspaper. The report that we received from the lawyer confirms this particular incident. He has been asked to spy on us. He has been asked to give information about the assumed relationship between Al Jazeera and Al Qaeda during his coverage in Afghanistan. And the man is still in jail, and he did not give any information. And unfortunately, even they have according to the reports that we received, he was told that if he gives this kind of information, he will be immediately discharged.
Ada Khanfar, who is the managing director of Al Jazeera, speaking to us when we went to Doha, to the headquarters of Al Jazeera. Rachel Morris, the condition of Sami Al-Haj now, the hunger strikes he has engaged in.
Well, I think, you know, the most sort of recent information that I have and the most sort of recent contact or, you know, intelligence that I've had through his lawyer is that, you know, obviously he's been on hunger strike since January the 10th of this year, and, you know, that would severely weaken a person. Of course, once you lose a certain amount of weight, you start to be force-fed at Guantanamo, and he has undergone that process, you know, I'm not sure how many times, but he's described it quite vividly in letters to his lawyer and, you know, describes it as being something very sort of painful and distressing to go through. But he also has other health problems in addition to, you know, the sort of physical weaknesses brought on by not eating for, you know, several months, which include, I think, when he was first brought to Bagram in Afghanistan, he somehow managed to get a knee injury, which I think he said was from being left out in the cold for quite some time by American forces, and he has sort of other health problems that have grown worse in, you know, in the years that he's been in Guantanamo.
And Scott Horton, obviously Al Jazeera has borne the brunt of a lot of these American attacks on the media. You talk about Al Jazeera specifically, what it's undergone?
Well, that's right. I mean, of course, one of the Downing Street papers that came out was a minute of a meeting that occurred at Blair House between Prime Minister Blair and President Bush, at which Bush proposed to him that they bomb the headquarters of Al Jazeera. And in fact, at that point, Donald Rumsfeld, one day earlier, had given a speech in which he had attacked Al Jazeera. Frank Gaffney and other leading neocons had openly in publications advocated bombing and attacks on Al Jazeera. And around this time, although Blair talked Bush out of the assault on the Al Jazeera headquarters, there were a number of bombings and shootings directed at Al Jazeera personnel. So people were killed, and this is a result of you know, decisions taken in the White House by the president to get Al Jazeera.
I want to just talk about the spike in killings in the last week. An Iraqi reporter working for the New York Times named Khaled Hassan shot dead on Friday. Gunmen also killed an Iraqi translator working for the Reuters news agency. Rachel is speaking to us from the Reuters newsroom in Washington, D.C. A total of three Reuters staffers have been killed in Iraq in the past week. Last Thursday, Reuters photographer Namir Nur al-Din and driver Saeed Khmag were killed in what witnesses said was a U.S. helicopter attack. Reuters news agency is now calling for a thorough investigation. We have just a few seconds, Scott Horton. Can you talk about the significance of this as well? Reuters very heavily hit.
Very heavily hit. I think we're in a situation now where journalists are specific targets in this war. And they are viewed by the insurgents as being associated with the West, with the occupiers, with the Americans, and they're viewed by the Americans with suspicion as being associated with the insurgents. It's a hopeless predicament for them.
Scott Horton, I want to thank you very much for being with us. New York attorney who specializes in international law and human rights, and Rachel Morris as well, an editor at the Washington Monthly cover story of the Columbia Journalism Review on Sami Al-Haj. And thank you also, Scott, for talking about Bilal Hussein. That does it for our broadcast. If you'd like a copy of the show, you can get a DVD at our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Hovda Kudus, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Matei, Anjali Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Carrie Mache, Kizzy Cox, John Gerber, and Andalusia Noel, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, engineers. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.